It's really ironic that BP's oil spill in the Gulf managed to stop other Arctic drilling, but it didn't stop BP's Arctic drilling.
Environmental groups asked Secretary Salazar to put a hold on BP's Liberty Project. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 1st of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a near-death experience after an encounter with plants.
It is known by the indigenous people to be one of the most toxic plants on the Northwest Coast.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Several environmental groups are asking Interior Secretary Ken Salazar to delay BP's plan to begin drilling to reach its Liberty Reservoir off Alaska's coast. The oil reserve is located in federal waters in the Beaufort Sea, but the company will access it from a gravel drilling pad about a mile off Alaska's coast. BP is using a technology called Ultra Extended Reach for the Liberty Project that involves drilling down 2 miles and then horizontally 6 to 8 miles to tap into the oil. The technology is not new, but the project is likely to set a record for the longest extended reach well in the world. The environmental groups say the project is too risky, given the disaster that's still unfolding in the Gulf of Mexico. Rebecca Noblin is Alaska Director for the Center for Biological Diversity.
It's common sense that BP shouldn't be allowed to be starting new drilling projects right now when they are completely busy cleaning up the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. They haven't been able to cap the well in the Gulf of Mexico. They haven't been able to contain the spill. They certainly haven't been able to clean up the oil.
After the Gulf spill, the Interior Department issued a moratorium on new offshore oil drilling in deep water until a presidential commission investigates the incident. That stopped Shell from drilling exploratory wells this summer in the Chukchi and Beaufort Sea, and Noblin says it should apply to the Liberty Project, too.
It's really ironic that BP's oil spill in the Gulf managed to stop other Arctic drilling, but it didn't stop BP's Arctic drilling. And I think that this project sort of flew under the radar, but it absolutely should not. It should fall under the moratorium.
BP says the project doesn't fall under the moratorium in part because it is drilling from a land-based rig sitting on a man-made island in less than 10 feet of water. The project is also tapping into a proven reserve of oil. The company acknowledges there are technical challenges with ultra-extended reach drilling, but BP spokesman Steve Reinhart says the complex project has been carefully developed over the last several years.
We won't do this if we can't do it safely.
And Reinhart says the company is continually evaluating the project to ensure the design, materials, and systems meet the company's high standards.
If the Interior Department seeks an additional review of the project, we will, of course, cooperate with that. I think it's important to remember that Liberty will be drilled with a land rig from a gravel pad the size of 23 football fields connected to shore by a gravel road. No part of this project is in contact with the Beaufort Sea.
BP had hoped to begin drilling this fall, but Reinhart says given the increased federal attention to the project and the company's own desire to make sure it moves ahead safely, drilling isn't likely to begin until next year. The Liberty Reservoir is estimated to hold 100 million barrels of oil. The state has approved licensing Usabelli Coal to look for natural gas in the Healy area. The area's coal bed methane potential raised concerns when Usabelli filed an initial request to explore back in 2003, and as KUAC's Dan Bross reports from Fairbanks, shallow gas development is still controversial.
The state's final best interest finding gives Healy-based coal mine operator Yusuf Belli the right to explore for gas on over 208,000 acres on both sides of the park's highway and Nenana River outside Denali National Park. Yusuf Belli Vice President of New Development Steve Denton says the area has undefined coal bed methane potential.
It really depends upon the volume that we find. It could be a small enough volume that all we can really do is serve our own needs here with it at the coal mine. But, there is the potential for finding volumes big enough that it might even make sense to run a pipeline to Fairbanks, let's say. But that's kind of, pie in the sky sort of dream right now. Likely will be somewhere in between those two.
Denton says Yusuf Belli has not even developed an exploration plan at this point. State Department of Natural Resources Oil and Gas Leasing Unit Manager Bruce Busby says subsequent approval is required for any actual exploratory drilling or seismic survey work.
This is a property interest, and so it allows the company to go out and think about doing exploration. It does not allow them to actually go out and do anything. It allows them to then apply for permits and to go through that process.
People who participated in review of a preliminary best interest finding 5 years ago have 20 days to appeal the final finding. Denali Citizens Council President Nancy Bale isn't happy with how the state is handling the exploration license.
DNR has chosen in the middle of a busy summer when in the Denali borough, most people are extremely busy to issue a final finding, and the final finding has caveats. For instance, only people who had standing can even comment on the final finding. So anyone who has found an interest in this area and didn't comment on the preliminary finding is excluded from even appealing this finding. The other problem is having only 20 days to comment.
Bale says the Denali Citizens Council is filing an initial appeal seeking a 60-day comment period that's open to everyone. She says the environmental group supports development of clean-burning natural gas, but longtime local concerns about some of the lands included in the exploration area remain.
There were a lot of people who felt that areas that were commonly settled should be excluded. We also argued that the Stampede Townships or the Wolf Townships, because they'd been designated by the state itself as having primary value for wildlife habitat and public recreation, the state should show some reticence to support industrial development in those areas.
The DNR's Busby says staffing and other higher priority projects delayed the state's processing of the best interest finding on Healy Gas. He says the state has previously granted similar best interest findings for gas exploration in the Susitna, Holitna, and Copper River basins. Exploration licenses can be converted into development leases if a company finds gas. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Alaska Attorney General's Office announced today a nearly $430,000 settlement with Tesoro and Seabulk Tankers Incorporated over the grounding of the Seabulk Pride on February 2, 2006 near Nikiski. The vessel was taking on petroleum products from Tesoro's refinery in heavy ice conditions when the tanker broke away from the Kenai Pipeline Company dock. The crew could not start the ship's engine, and it grounded. About 84 gallons of gasoline spilled from loading lines. The companies admit no violations. State officials said the crew failed to meet key requirements of winter ice operating rules. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a camp that gets kids excited about learning.
Continuously exposing kids to programs like this does increase their interests in science and technology.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northrim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. Northrim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska is asking the court system to stop enforcement of a law that went into effect today, redefining the court system's conditions to grant bail to some people charged with felonies. The bill passed the legislature during this year's session and was quickly signed into law by the governor in May. The comprehensive bill was described at the time as a change to statutes that had not been updated in more than 40 years, and, according to the governor, would protect all Alaskans and particularly many of our most vulnerable friends and neighbors. The ACLU's executive director, Jeffrey Mittman, in the legal complaint that will be heard in court tomorrow, says the law doesn't conform with the national idea of a person being presumed innocent before convicted. He says it also doesn't take into account Alaska's own constitution that has a provision guaranteeing a right to bail.
What this bail bill does is it completely ignores the constitution. It sets up rules that violate the right to constitution, violate the right to privacy, violate the right to due process. And because of these constitutional issues, it's important to the ACLU to challenge us on behalf of criminal defendants who would not have an opportunity at their bail hearings to raise these sorts of issues.
The state, however, says the new statute does not go beyond either the state or U.S. Constitution. Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, Rick Svobodny, says it was carefully written to keep within those limits. He says that having a right to bail allows the legislature to set the criteria for setting that bail. He also says that the statute does not restrict a given right.
A judge, just as has always been the case since statehood, before statehood, has the right and the authority to set conditions of bail. The court needs to set bail that's reasonable to assure a person's appearance and to protect society.
The merits of the case will be argued in Anchorage Superior Court tomorrow morning, where the ACLU will ask for a temporary restraining order to stop the bill's implementation. Five Canadian hikers are back on the Chilkoot Trail after fully recovering from nearly lethal plant poisoning. From Member Station KHNS, Tara Bicknell reports.
The group had been following the historic trail made famous by Gold Rush pioneers when they consumed the perilous false hellebore. They were evacuated to Skagway and Whitehorse after the poison began to cause serious symptoms. Tim Stidell, chief ranger at Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park, says it started one evening last week with a radio call from a hiking ranger.
Actually, it was a Parks Canada ranger who, just by coincidence, was traveling down from the Chilkoot Pass. They usually don't come that far onto our side of the Chilkoot Trail, but they were doing their orientation hike on the U.S. side, so he was coming down to stay the night at sheep camp.
It was fortunate timing, actually, because the sheep camp ranger on duty was already gone, and the next ranger wasn't due to arrive until later that night.
Fortunately, Sean, the Parks Canada ranger, was hiking through the sheep camp campground on his way to the ranger station when he encountered the five hikers who had consumed plants earlier that afternoon, and were one of them in particular was beginning to present with pretty serious symptoms associated with plant poisoning, severe vomiting, and kind of the need for diarrhea.
The hikers, most of them from Ontario, recognized that it was probably something they had eaten along the hike. For a few days, the French-speaking travelers had been eating native plants, starting with common edibles like watermelon berries or twisted stalk plant.
They came across the false hellebore, and it is known by the indigenous people to be one of the most toxic plants on the northwest coast. And it has actually been used in very minute quantities for medicinal purposes, but it doesn't take very much before it to become lethally toxic when consumed, particularly the bulb of the plant, which is what these individuals actually consumed.
If you look the false hellebore up in a field guide or online, its images are paired with skulls and crossbones, grim reapers, and plenty of warnings in big red letters that say things like highly toxic. It can cause birth defects, gastrointestinal distress, salivation, prostration, general paralysis, spasms, irregular heartbeat, difficulty breathing, and death.
And then when you start reading up on the reference material, we got the call and realized that they had been eating the false hellebore. We knew it was toxic. We weren't quite sure about the seriousness of it until we started pulling out our plant books and realized pretty quickly as we were reading into it that it is the most toxic plant on the northwest coast and can quickly result in unconsciousness followed by death. So at that point, we realized we got to get these folks out of there.
The individual cases ranged in severity. The hiker with the most serious symptoms had eaten only a couple of bulbs, while the others ate only a portion of one fingertip-sized bulb.
The one patient was presenting severely enough by the time they got back to the clinic, they were in crisis situation. And fortunately, by the end of the evening, the clinic was able to stabilize them.
A helicopter navigated through marginal weather conditions to retrieve all five patients from sheep camp and deliver them to Dahl Memorial Clinic's new and more accommodating facility in town.
If he hadn't been able to get through, the likelihood of us getting particularly that one patient who was in the worst condition off the trail, I hate to think what might have happened if we couldn't get him out of there, because it was definitely, he was in serious condition.
Seidel has been with the park for 17 years now, and this is the first time he's seen an evacuation for plant poisoning. He explains the thought process that usually leads hikers to consume toxic plants.
I think some of this happened because folks had a little bit of knowledge, which sometimes can be dangerous, but didn't have full knowledge of the plants that they were working with and encountering. A little bit of group thought process happened here, where one individual felt kind of confident, and he described it as feeling invincible, that never would have thought a leafy plant would cause that much poison. He'd heard about berries and mushrooms being toxic, but never really thought that a green leafy plant like that could be that poisonous.
More information on poisonous and edible plants is at the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park office in Skagway. Reporting from Skagway, I'm Tara Bicknell with KHNS.
In Elfin Cove, residents continue to clean up after a fire 2 weeks ago that destroyed a lodge and restaurant. In Sitka, meanwhile, relief efforts are being organized by the restaurant owner's daughter, who says help is still needed in the community's rebuilding effort. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Lillian Piedra grew up in the large three-story house that was home to the Coho Bar and Grill, run by her mother, Shirley Perkins.
They make a wonderful blue cheeseburger, mushroom blue cheeseburger that's really good. And then, of course, there's always the pizza. And she has everything, you know, smoked salmon and cream cheese, and it gets pretty elaborate.
The Coho was part cafe and part gathering place in Elfin Cove, a community 70 miles west of Juneau that fluctuates between a population of a dozen or so in the winter and a couple hundred in the summer. The cafe, the attached home, and the neighboring Cove Lodge charter business were all destroyed by fire on June 19th. Everyone made it out, including Shirley and Lillian's sister, Mercedes. Lillian now lives in Sitka. She has a young son, which means traveling to Elfin Cove to help deal with the disaster is not an option.
The only real thing that I could do to help them was to organize something and try to get donations and things to help out the community and the people that lost everything.
And so that's exactly what she's doing. So far, she says donations are slow but steady. Some shoes have come in, and donations have come from all over.
There was even a wonderful woman over in Tenneke Springs who called me up and wanted to make a donation. She sent over a whole bunch of Carhartts and work gloves and things. And, you know, all the guys were just so happy to get that. And it was really nice. Someone out of town, you know, that just stepped forward and wanted to make a donation.
Lillian says she's organizing a benefit dinner for the cafe sometime in October. In the meantime, more donations of either materials or money are appreciated.
Size 8 or 9 men's wide tennis shoes would be really helpful. You know, they could still use some actual, like, Grundin-type work pants, some rain gear. We did get some, like, wind-type resistant pants, but some actual rain gear would be really nice. You know, even if somebody wants to make, like, a small donation of cash, that way we could go out and buy some stuff for the people.
Lillian says her mother wants to move forward and rebuild, restoring a place known for its mushroom blue cheeseburgers and pizza, but valued for so much more than that.
I think if she wasn't able to come up with something and rebuild, I think a lot of people would be at a loss, and it would just be so wonderful, you know, if she could get on her feet again and keep moving forward.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Sea Alaska shareholders re-elected four board incumbents Saturday in Craig. They also rejected a measure that would have weakened board powers. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on the Southeast Regional Native Corporation's annual meeting.
12 people ran for four seats on Sea Alaska's 13-member board of directors. The top vote-getters were incumbents Patrick Anderson of Anchorage, Clarence Jackson of Cake, Jackie Johnson-Peta of Virginia, and Jody Mitchell of Juneau, each won three-year terms. Board Vice Chairwoman Rosita Worrell says the winning incumbents have made great contributions to the corporation, but she says the other candidates raised important issues too.
They offered a lot of good views and points, and we certainly will be looking at a lot of the things that they've said. We think it's a great thing when we have so many shareholders that are interested in the corporation.
Some independent candidates called for a more aggressive business strategy, including increased investments in Southeast communities. Other issues included larger dividends and funding for substance abuse treatment programs. Independent board candidate Michael Beasley, who placed fifth in the voting, authored a ballot resolution to largely end the practice of discretionary voting. That measure failed, gaining about 40% of the ballots cast.
Rather disappointing, but I got to say everything I wanted to say, and the response was good. We had nearly 5,000 people supporting it, so our voice is being heard, I believe.
Discretionary voting allows Sea Alaska's close to 21,000 shareholders to turn their ballot decisions over to the board. It's a popular option, but more than two-thirds of members choose their own preferences with what's called a directed vote. Critics such as Beasley say discretionary voting gives management an unfair advantage in elections, including this one. But he says he's not giving up trying to make a change.
There's other avenues, too. And that's by going up to the Alaska legislature and look at the corporation's code. They have a board up there. And I'd like to address them, you know. So there might be something to be done administratively in a different way, but still in a very positive way for the greater good of all shareholders.
Sea Alaska's board opposed the change, which has been before voters in past decades. Vice Chairwoman Worrell says it's a proven practice.
We have up to 30% of the votes that are cast discretionary. We think it's a right that they have to vote that way. People also have the directed votes, so they could vote directed if they so choose. But it's really a right of the shareholders, and the shareholders are saying for the fifth time, you know, that they want to protect that right.
After the annual meeting, Sea Alaska directors voted to keep Albert Kukesh as board chairman and Worrell as vice chairwoman. Kukesh is a state senator from Angoon, and Worrell heads up the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute in Juneau. Directors also appointed Barbara Blake from Heidelberg as youth board advisor. Blake is a shareholder who works for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Worrell says Blake will represent several thousand younger shareholders enrolled after a vote 3 years ago.
She has a college degree. She's already had great experience in Washington, D.C., working for federal agencies on issues that affect Alaska Natives. She's going to continue to do that, and I think she's going to be able to bring a voice to the board, you know, that we want to hear.
Sea Alaska is headquartered in Juneau, but has subsidiaries and partnerships around the country and in Mexico. It usually issues dividends twice a year. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Kids are taking flight in Juneau this week. 8th and 9th graders at the Flight Quest Day Camp are getting hands-on lessons in aerodynamics, physics, and math, making paper airplanes, balsa wood gliders, and model rockets. The Juneau Economic Development Council is putting on the camp, which features the world record holder for longest paper airplane flight. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
3, 2, 1, launch! Wow.
Standing in the middle of Thunder Mountain High School's lobby, 14-year-old Jordan Curry uses a rubber band and a ruler to fire a balsa wood glider high in the air toward the vaulted ceiling. The plane veers left and lands about 26 feet away, coming to rest against a bench. For his second attempt, Curry says he might try something different.
Instead of pulling back as hard, because I pulled back to 10 force, I might try just pulling back to like 5, so that because it sent it off to a curve.
Curry is taking part in this week's Flight Quest Day Camp, where campers are learning the principles of flight, things like lift, drag, weight, and thrust. Coming in, Curry says he had a lot of experience making model rockets, but not so much making paper airplanes and gliders. One day, he plans to put his interest in flying to use in the military.
I want to fly UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles in the Army. So thought this would be a good way to, you know, learn about how they all fly.
Guinness World Record holder for longest paper airplane flight Ken Blackburn is on hand to teach kids how flying works. An Air Force aeronautics engineer, Blackburn says you can teach a lot with a simple paper airplane.
Some of the fundamentals of flight apply all over, so a paper airplane is very easy and economical and quick way of demonstrating some of that.
Blackburn started making paper planes as a kid, coming up with the design for the longest flying plane when he was only 13. He set his first world record of 16.89 seconds in 1983 with a little encouragement from his college roommates. He's broken it 3 times since, most recently in 1998 when he flew a plane that stayed in the air 27.6 seconds. One of the lessons he tries to get across is that breaking a world record takes dedication and practice.
The last time I set the record, of course you have to do better than the last time. It took me 9 months of daily practice, including working out with weights, coming up with hundreds of modifications on the airplane, in order to finally be able to reset the record.
The Flight Quest Day Camp is put on by the Juneau Economic Development Council's STEM program, which stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. Another recent STEM workshop taught kids to make remotely operated underwater vehicles for marine research. Later this month, STEM hosts an alternative energy camp to teach kids about wind, hydro, and solar power. JEDC education specialist Bob Veith says the goal is to spark kids' interest in science and technology careers.
Continuously exposing kids to programs like this does increase their interests in science and technology. And even if they don't go into the science and technology workforce, at least they'll be scientifically more literate citizens.
Camper Jonathan Loney wants to be an engineer. He thinks Flight Quest will help him get there, but at this point, it's mostly just for fun.
I just like building things.
JEDC charged $150 for the week-long camp, and Veith says all 20 slots were filled. A grant from the U.S. Defense Department paid for Ken Blackburn's travel. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Ooh, you got a much nicer flight than he did. Holy cow, that was really nice.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you miss any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Tara Bicknell in Skagway, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Ed Schoenfeld and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by the Alaska State Elks Association, offering the Alaska State Elks Camp in the Matanuska Valley, available for weddings, parties, reunions, and other public or private meetings. Information at alaskastateelks.com. If you've been through a lot of bad things and you feel like everyone would be better off without you, suicide isn't the answer. You're not alone. You have people who love you, and there is help. Call the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-HELP. Call, share, and live. If you're thinking about suicide, call for help at 1-877-266-HELP. This message sponsored by the Mindy Schloss Memorial Fund and the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.